For me, I was nominated by Sir David Cannadine. I had first met Sir David about 3 years ago at a conference in Austin. I was a very junior, untenured assistant professor at the University of Arkansas at the time. Sir David was the keynote speaker, and I had just read with my graduate students an essay David had published in the late 1980s in which he had suggested that the future of British history was very grim. And my students, knowing that I would see him, had encouraged me to approach him and ask if he still held that view some 12, 15 years later. So I approached David and asked the question and expected the typical 30-second response that you usually get from those such as he. But instead, David suggested I grab a bottle of red wine. We headed out to the patio and spoke for 2-3 hours that night. And then since that time, David has really acted as a mentor to me. The last book I published, he read the manuscript and gave me extensive feedback on that. He's read articles along the way. We've corresponded. And then this past November, or October, I should say, I was fortunate enough to bring David to campus where he offered a public lecture. And at that time, he asked whether I would be interested in being elected to the fellowship.
And you said yes.
I did indeed.
What about you?
Well, I'm on a committee with the person who recommended me, a fellow named Wilf Prest. Wilfred Prest is an eminent historian in Australia. Our election would suggest that the Royal Historical Society is now a global enterprise. And although it's still headquartered in London at the University College, University of London, it has ceased to be a strictly English game and is now very much a global game of people interested in history and professionals who work especially in British history in one way or another. Wilf is the chair of a committee that I've been working with for several years on a tercentenary edition of the commentaries of Sir William Blackstone. And I've helped negotiate an agreement between the committee and Oxford University Press, for whom I do a considerable amount of work as a series editor on a variety of projects. And Wilf had suggested that this might be appropriate when we met in London last summer, and I said that I'd be very, very pleased if this were to happen because, among other things, the Society has a variety of forms of information that it makes available to its members and fellows that would be very useful. And Wilf just thought it'd be a lot of fun. So he put forward my nomination at about the same time that David was putting forward Ben's.
Now, you and Ben are friends.
Yes.
If I understand correctly. Like friends, or, acquaintances?
I'm not sure if I may want to qualify that if this is going out on the air, but ostensibly, yes, we are friends.
Well, I mean, I'd loan him money if that's.
So, was this planned in some way, or was this just a coincidence?
I think
it was complete coincidence. Steve actually called me when I was on my daughter's playground in early December and suggested that he had heard that he might be nominated for this. And I was able to say, well, it's curious that has happened to you because I was just speaking to Sir David, and apparently I will also be nominated.
So we sort of decided that that was a nice thing for each of us, and it was, I think, in Ben's case, it was certainly well-merited. I think in my case, it's probably more of a question of who you know, and in Ben's case, it's more of a question of what you do. But in any event, the British are a very forgiving people, and if they want to do that, that's fine with me. And so, but it was a nice thing. It's not an honor that the University of Arkansas has had, just so far as we know, in the past. I think it's a hallmark in many ways of the more global effect of the faculty work here.
Now, you are a law professor at the University of Arkansas, Steve. How does that result into a fellowship in history?
Well, I teach legal history, and among other things.
Okay.
One could say that all law is history. There's very little law that one can teach that isn't historical. And the more one understands the context in which the ideas arose, the more ably one can use those ideas today. But in my case, I've made a particular investment in legal history. The largest single project that I've done until quite recently took about a decade to develop a modern edition of the writings of a very important English judge named Sir Edward Coke. Coke was the Chief Justice of England at the very moment when the English colonies were being established in North America and was very influential in the redefinition of the common law from the Middle Ages to the modern period. I've done some more recent work, including work in the colonial administration of India by the English.
Ben, could you talk about your research interests?
Yeah, absolutely. As Steve said, a very different track to his. All of my research centers on 20th century British imperial history. My last book was just published this past May. It's called Imperial Endgame, Britain's Dirty Wars and the End of Empire by Palgrave Macmillan. Far less pleasant reading than what Steve works on. What I looked at was the endgame of empire after the Second World War in Palestine, Malaya, Kenya, Aden, and Cyprus. The story that has been told so far is that Britain's end of empire was one of disarray, chaos, ad hoc reactions to pressures on the ground. And what I discovered in numerous archive trips was that this was actually not at all the case, that beginning around 1948, 1949, the British government developed a very clear strategy. And this strategy was that they would devolve powers to the colonies, grant them independence on Britain's terms in the hope that they would remain in the Western sphere during the Cold War rather than seek communist aid. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that there were elements in each of these societies which were not in on the plan, shall we say, who didn't agree with the British government's interpretation of how empire should end.
Hmm.
And for those people, Britain had to hit them and hit them quite hard in what I call Britain's dirty wars.
Now, I was talking to Ben earlier, and he said that you have a lot of ideas that you share with him, you know, about projects or...
Projects, schemes, yes. Ambitions, things where he constantly tries to get me into trouble, and I usually go along with
him. What are these ideas?
Well, we are looking in every way, as any good university must. We have to be entrepreneurial. We have to find opportunities that we can bring home and make available for our students and our colleagues. And so we're always a little bit on the search, but also have to be imaginative and create opportunities. And so, for instance, we have discussed the potential of developing a lectureship that would have Mr. McLeish here more often, but also other problems that might be solved by greater collaboration between Fulbright and law and also the Clinton School and business and agriculture and education and the other programs working with the World Trade Center. We can do a lot of things. And so the hope will be over time that we will find greater efficiency by collaboration and that we will find greater opportunity by being able to present the multifaceted opportunities of all these departments to bring opportunity here that wouldn't otherwise arrive. That is a moving target.
What I would add to that is I think far too often in academia we become boxed in with our own research agenda. So I'm concentrating on post-war 20th century counterinsurgency. Steve is concentrating on legal history. Other historians, other lawyers are concentrating on their own specific research interests. The pressures are there, and there is the danger that we'll move forward in separate tracks without interaction, without collaboration. What Steve and I both strongly believe is that the university will be stronger if the various departments, the various schools, the various colleges can work together to as great an extent as possible. And that's what we've really tried to do over the last few years.
Now, when you're a fellow, what do you need to do to sustain the fellowship?
Well, there's something tremendously mundane but very essential, which is pay the dues. Sure that you've received appropriate correspondence in that regard as well.
Yes.
But because it is a private association, the Royal Historical Society is the beneficiary of the patronage of the monarch. Queen Elizabeth is its patron. Queen Victoria was its first patron. It's been going along, but it's still a private society. It's not subsidized by a government. It is sustained by the funds contributed by its membership and by the occasional donor. And so in order for it to engage in its work, which includes hosting public lectures, encouraging the teaching of history through a variety of means, publishing extremely important scholarly works, especially in the Camden series, it does all of these things, but it does so fueled by the voluntary contributions of the fellowship. And so part of what we do is simply we send money in and hope scholarship comes out. But another thing that we do is we participate in the flow of information. There is a tremendous amount of information shared among the fellowship through the central office in London. And so we know about meetings and public lectures that are happening. We have access to the transactions, the annual meeting if we aren't able to attend. We may attend some of the meetings and some of the public lectures when we can get there. But the most important thing is that we're able to collaborate by the transmission of this information. We know what research is being done by different fellows and members in different places, and also know of opportunities that are made available to the society through the fellows and membership and allied institutions, including other libraries and archival groups. And that is a global enterprise.
Since being elected a fellow in early December, the email traffic has been constant, with the most fascinating lectures, advertisements, news of whatever fellows' research is working on, issues of interest to historians, public advocacy, and the like. So there is a great sense of being connected with the world beyond Arkansas and indeed beyond the United States within the Royal Historical Society.
The University of Arkansas is one of three or four schools that has two Royal Historical Society fellows in the SSC. What kind of responsibility does that mean?
I feel that in answer to that, we should have feathered hats or something that we ought to have to wear on commencement. But I'm quite hopeful. The provost is listening. That's not really a suggestion. But I think the fundamental purposes of these fellowships are to serve, to develop one's own scholarship in the service of history, to work to educate the public, and especially those that are given to our charge by the university. That is our fundamental job, and that is no change because we have these additional opportunities that are made available through this specialized organization. Reading the bylaws, I noticed that one could be asked to leave if one behaved badly, but I think the idea is that one will behave well and that one will do those things a professional historian ought to do. And I have to say it's a very interesting thing to have this conversation about a global enterprise of history. It won't have failed many of our listeners to notice that a person who claims membership in the tribe of historians is running for public office. And that, I think, is an opportunity to engage in a debate as to what is an historian. Is an historian somebody who just says, that is history, or here is what I say is history, or is it, in fact, a rich collaboration with certain techniques that try to ascertain the best understanding possible of events, of things, and of people's actions in the past? And I think that the Royal Historical Society does stand for a special tradition of historical research that might be dented by popular notions of what is an historian, but is very robust and will survive that.
Yeah, history is inherently an interdisciplinary subject. It would be impossible for me to do my research, at least, without an understanding of economics, of sociology, of philosophy, of law. The society recognizes that, which I think is why it's so appropriate that we have both a member of the history department in the Fulbright College and a member of the School of Law, both elected to the society at the same time.
Now, the Royal Historical Society considers itself the guardian of history. Do you guys consider yourself guardians of history?
Well, I think I'd have to say yes. I think every historian feels some pride in the technique of history and the efforts of historians past and present. That there is something wonderful in knowing more that history allows, and in trying to refine that knowledge into the best possible understanding. And it doesn't mean just throwing out a bumper sticker sometimes. It means carefully working through the nuances and the ambiguities and the gaps. Frequently, historians will tell us that the most important thing we know is the extent to which we don't know and cannot know fully what we'd like to know about the past, and that we have to do the best we can understanding those gaps and not trying to fill them in ignorance or in hope or fear. And so I do think that we have a particular responsibility to guard the past from misuse, and sometimes to stand up and say, you know, really, you think that's what happened, but that's not what happened. And we can demonstrate why a falsity exists much more easily than we can demonstrate accuracy, because it's so hard. It's sometimes very difficult to know from a very imperfect archive what really took place in the past. And asking for respect for our ignorance is almost as important as asking for respect for our knowledge.
I think all of that is true on an individual level. So in that sense, all historians are guardians of the past and the profession. I think the society also fulfills, particularly in the UK, a political role, as I'm sure you're aware, with rising tuition fees, with cutting state budgets, with the austerity measures that are sweeping through Europe. Each profession needs its own advocacy to be able to express, as Steve just did very clearly, what the role is of historians, what the responsibility of historians is, and what the very real need for history is. And I think the society fulfills that function also on a collective level, which then allows each historian to do individually what Steve has just articulated.
All
Thank
right.
you, guys.
Terrific.